Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Friday, November 29th, 2019. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, on the program today, the Society of Black Alumni Presidential Professor and Professor of History at Johns Hopkins University, Martha S. Jones, on her book, Birthright Citizens, A History of Race and Rights in Antebellum America. Ladies and gentlemen, to celebrate Thanksgiving, I hope you had a happy one. We have taken today off, but had this great interview with Martha S. Jones. Regular listeners will know that I have am developing quite a thing for a Reconstruction. This is the period following the Civil War in this country. It's when the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments to the Constitution were passed. And in many respects, the America that we live in today, that era was really the founding era of the America that we live in today. And it was a time, it's a fascinating time. And we're going to try and do more on Reconstruction, you know, just to break up the sheer horror of the era that we're living in. But it's also very instructive, not to mention that's when the one of the three impeachments that we've had in this country took place. Andrew Johnson was impeached. He was not convicted in the Senate. I think they missed it by one vote. We talked to, spoke to Alex Perrine about that the other day. The radical Republicans at the time, they started things like public school and many other inventions, as it were. It also was an era that led into a Supreme Court that was incredibly conservative, that allowed for suppression of voting rights, that created an era that basically shut the door to a lot of progressive changes in this country. So a fascinating era. And this is a fascinating look at the concept of birthright citizenship, which obviously is big in play and conservatives are going after. So it's an interesting talk, I think. I certainly enjoyed it. And we will be back live on Monday. Just a reminder, you can support this show by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you get the show commercial free and you get extra content on every other day except for today. Today we're just doing this, because, you know, want to be there, for you, but, a lot of people don't, you know, a lot of people out of their regular flow of things, but you can, listen to this and, listen to, Wednesday's show. We will be back live on Monday. We've got, more impeachment hearings next week, but, not fact witnesses. So I don't know how much of that we will carry, at least live. We will probably cover it, you know, after the fact. We've got debates coming up over the next month or so. Congress is going to return. There's a continuing resolution. And we may see a government shutdown. Unlikely, though, because the Democrats bungled this, as far as I'm concerned. But all this and more. So buckle up. The next 12 months are going to be nuts. And then perhaps maybe the months after that as well. Take a quick break. Be right back with Martha S. Jones on Birthright Citizens. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Professor Martha S. Jones. She is the Society of Black Alumni Presidential Professor and Professor of History at the Johns Hopkins University and author of Birthright Citizens, A History of Race and Rights in Antebellum America. Welcome to the program, Martha.
Thanks for having me.
So I don't know if this constitutes a myth, but I think certainly my belief, let's put it that way, was that the idea of birthright citizenship almost like completely fully formed in post-Civil War era, the Reconstruction era, and as a function of the three amendments that were sort of the hallmark of the Reconstruction era. Your work basically outlines the presence of this idea, I guess, or the germination of this idea in the pre-Civil War era. You looked at Baltimore. Why Baltimore?
Before the Civil War, Baltimore is home to the largest community of free African Americans, former slaves, in the United States. It sits at a geographic and political crossroads. It is, by and large, a free city in a slaveholding state. And it is home to some of the most notorious of the pre-war era's legal elite, including Roger Brooke Tawney, who some of your listeners may know his name because he authors the Dred Scott decision in 1857 that says no black person can be a citizen of the United States. So all of those things come together to let us explore a story about the origins of this idea of birthright citizenship in a community that is actively struggling around whether they belong and by what terms they might belong in the United States as well as in Baltimore.
And it's that tension of freed black slaves in a slave state that basically folks develop, I guess, responses to Dred Scott. So why don't we discuss maybe some of those responses? You look at some specific individuals and how their stories, I guess, tell the story of the development of birthright citizenship. George Horton. Tell us who George Horton was.
Well, Horton is stands in for a really important group of African American men who, after the war, after the Revolutionary War, are making their way as free people, are relegated to some of the most brutal and menial labor in many American cities, and sign up to be sailors as a way to claim some dignity around their labor, but also to broaden their perspectives on the world. So Horton is a sailor. He disembarks, as sailors do, when his ship comes in to port, and walking on the streets of Washington, D.C., is accosted by what is typical in Washington, folks who are looking to make a dollar, perhaps, on the fines that might be imposed on someone who was captured as a fugitive. And he ignites a debate both within the courts of Washington, but within the political newspapers of the period and in his home state of New York, because it turns out that while on the streets of Washington, he's an unknown figure, In New York, in upstate New York, where he's from, he's a well-known individual. And by the time his story is done, he's threatened with sale as into servitude as a fugitive. Leading lights of New York's legal culture, including the governor of New York State, will intervene, thankfully, to ensure that he gains his liberty. So he stands in for really an important community of men who are traveling by way of the Atlantic, traveling by way of rivers, by canals, and as they move through space are being accosted, accused, treated as non-citizens, and the puzzle for them is how to prove that they in fact are, and in fact they are people entitled to rights.
And just place us, I mean, where is his story operative relative to Dred Scott? And the Dred Scott decision came down in 1857, and, in many respects, well, I mean, I guess maybe the wheels are grinding towards war anyways, but certainly grease those wheels. When we talk about Horton, like whose experience, I mean, he's representing, you know, sort of a broad swath of men's experience at that time. When would that have been, and how much would Dred Scott completely foreclose any sort of like, I don't know, legal nooks and crannies or toe holds that had been developed, or would that still sort of dance around Dred Scott?
It's a great question, because men like Horton are active both in terms of their daily lives, but also in courthouses and in legislatures well before Dred Scott, pushing on this point of view, this claim that they are citizens of the United States. And it turns out that Dred Scott, though it's the case that we remember because it is notorious for its brutal language, that Dred Scott is a pretty late volley. By the time we get to 1857, free African Americans have been claiming to be citizens of the United States for many decades, at least going back to the 18 teens. And so Justice Taney, who decides Dred Scott, is in essence trying to shut down that debate, right? Trying to shut down that movement, trying to settle the question. And it's an important point you raise. Does Dred Scott then thwart all that? And it turns out when we look closely at what happens after Dred Scott, the answer is no. That in fact, by the time we get to 1857, the debate around black citizenship is complex enough, it is sophisticated enough, it is controversial enough that African Americans can find judges, can find state lawmakers who will affirm them as citizens of the United States, even in the face of Dred Scott. So while Justice Taney's language in Dred Scott is devastating, and yes, it turns up the stakes, if you will, for African Americans with respect to the question of citizenship and ultimately the stakes in the Civil War, all of that is true. But my interest was really in closer to the ground, the experience of everyday life. And did Dred Scott change everyday life for former slaves? And with some exceptions, the best answer we have is no, it didn't.
Hey, okay, so when you say, you know, you described sort of the pursuit of citizenship by the time we get to Dred Scott as more complicated and more sort of, I guess, developed. I mean, when we use those type of adjectives, are we basically just talking about there have been, I don't know, tens or hundreds of little battles or questions that, or maybe thousands, across the country, as it were at that time, where individuals will make this decision or will make a decision that has implications, because there's no real holding right? There's no grand edict as to who's a citizen before Dred Scott. And then I should say also, it sort of feels like that part of the Dred Scott decision seems to be more reasoning as opposed to, I mean, because the Dred Scott was not specifically a case about our black people, are they eligible to be American citizens? It was more sort of the reasoning as to why a black person could be brought back from one state to another. I mean, it was sort of like a weird assault on states' rights, I guess, on some level, or not. I don't know. It depends on which perspective. But I mean, so when you talk about the sort of the law being mature and complicated at that point, it's because in each little locality, some decision is being made that maybe not explicitly about citizenship indicates citizenship in some way.
Yeah, so you're painting absolutely the picture that I discover in Birthright Citizens, that depending on who you ask and where you are and what the circumstances are, you may get one or another answer about whether or not free African Americans are citizens of the United States. And I understand the impulse to treat a Supreme Court decision as somehow having greater force than all of those hundreds or thousands of small decisions. But even a Supreme Court decision requires that judges in lower courts, local officials, and African Americans themselves, in a sense, respect that decision and abide by its terms. And it turns out, in the example of Dred Scott, that courts, lower courts, adjacent courts, are really reluctant and resist the insistence, if you will, that Justice Taney has tried to impose and continue to treat Black Americans as citizens of the United States. Now I'm going to take you into the weeds for just 2 seconds to say the issue in Dred Scott is many things, including whether or not the Scots are free or enslaved people. Of course, that is the core of the case. But the reason we get to the citizenship question in Dred Scott is because Scott has brought his case now in federal court, and the federal courts have authority only to hear a limited range of cases, including cases brought by citizens of the United States. And this means that before the court can get to the merits, right, to the heart of Dred Scott, it has to determine whether or not he actually is someone eligible to bring his case before a federal court. Hence, the court goes to this question of citizenship, and it has implications once the court holds that no black person is a citizen of the United States. It is a bar against African Americans using the federal courts, be they enslaved or free. So that's how we get there, is because Scott has tried to use the federal courts, which are only open to citizens of the United States, and the court concludes that he's not a citizen, and hence his case should be dismissed.
So that was just a case of standing, and the court found he had no standing, at least, or there was no jurisdiction in the context of federal courts.
Yeah, and then Justice Taney, Justice Taney overreaches,
right,
and then goes to the next question, and that's how we get to then the conclusion that no black person can be a citizen of the United States, and that Scott himself is a slave.
So, and I don't want to get too caught up on this, but when we talk about lower courts being somewhat reluctant to read this decision as being binding in that specific way, how much of geography played into which courts would and would not? And when we say those lower courts, are we talking in the federal system? Are we talking in the state system? And I'm just curious as to how that was dispersed and to what extent that was something that may have, fueled ultimately the war.
Sure. So both state courts and federal courts, lower federal courts, are charged oftentimes with determining who is a citizen of the United States, and those kinds of cases continue after Dred Scott. And in my research, the only state I could find in which a lower federal court upheld the reasoning in Dred Scott on the question of black citizenship, the only case I could find was one case in the state of Mississippi. And there, the court had flip-flopped. Originally, it had rejected the logic of Dred Scott and then comes back to adopt it. But it turns out, as best I can determine, to be the exception rather than the rule, that when we look across the whole of the U.S., both in state courts, such as Maryland, the state I study, or federal courts in the Midwest, those courts will distinguish the circumstances of the black people who come before them from the case of Dred Scott and permit African Americans to use the federal courts as citizens, if you will, despite Dred Scott.
So this is this is basically the landscape and the sort of the origins of birthright citizenship prior to the war, much of this is basically ultimately will be rolled into the 15th Amendment in Reconstruction. Where were the other sources? I mean, we have these isolated cases, and you write about other men who bring up other sort of, I guess, issues or, you know, reveal other perspectives. Where else was the idea of birthright citizenship growing? And were there any sort of like competing notions of citizenship?
It's a great question. So African Americans are using a forum that come to be called the Colored Conventions. This is a shadow convention movement that parallels political parties and state legislatures. And so we look, for example, at the ways in which black Americans are working through this idea, developing it, debating it, and they do so in the context of this Colored Convention movement. We can look at state constitutional conventions. Maryland is my example, and in 1850-51, Maryland lawmakers rewrite their constitution, and they debate this question. We can look at the floor of Congress, where as early as 1821, when Congress is contemplating admitting Missouri as a new state, a question arises with respect to how Missouri should regard black Americans who might want to enter into the new state. And Congress debates whether or not black people are entitled to the privileges and immunities of the equality of citizenship that would entitle them to enter Missouri. So part of the work in Birthright Citizens is to piece together all of these varied places in which the question of citizenship is being debated. Now, the thing I would say is that part of what African Americans do very early on is they read closely the Constitution of 1787, the original Constitution, to see if there isn't language there, there isn't a suggestion there about who they might be. And they fix on what for a long time was a rather ignored clause in the Constitution, one that requires the citizen to the president to be a natural born citizen of the United States. And they say two things, right? First is, well, if the president is a natural born citizen, there must be such a category, right? And the Constitution acknowledges it. And secondly, there's no color line in this Constitution. And so if the president is a natural born citizen, why aren't we also? And this really is the seed, right, that they then germinate for a very long time, looking to interpret the original Constitution as providing for birthright and advocating that and observing that white men and women and children are unequivocally citizens of the United States when they are born in the United States. And so, again, this category must exist The debate really is whether blackness, whether racism can function in law constitutionally as a bar to their claim to belonging. By the time we get to the Civil War era, all of this is very quickly up for debate. By 1862, the United States Attorney General Edward Bates will issue an opinion from his office that really upturns Dred Scott and says, yes, free African Americans are citizens. The Civil Rights Act of 1866 will affirm that by its language. And then in 1868, the 14th Amendment will constitutionalize birthright and, if you will, affirm or settle the debate that African Americans have been generating for a very long time.
Was there an organized and strategic I guess a place or an entity or institutions that were organizing and sort of like plotting this strategically. The idea that we can, you know, that we have, there is this category that exists, natural born citizen. And it just so happens that that category is relevant if you're going to become president. But if that exists, you know, like you say, if it exists, what does it take to be that? It doesn't say anything about your color. It just says you need to be born in the United States. Is there an organization that is pushing the urge that is like attempting to push this forward, this concept, or is this just sort of like piecemeal as you know, sort of various other cases come up?
Sure. So I've mentioned the colored conventions, which is really the most sustained and robust of African-American political organizations before the Civil War. In fact, the conventions will continue even after the war. So there is a place where Black Americans are debating this question alongside anti-slavery, alongside education and labor and all of the issues of the day. In addition to that, we have, for example, in Baltimore, an organization late in the 1820s called the Legal Rights Association. And these are local Black activists who band together, and their purpose is indeed to try and build a case that they are citizens of the United States. They will appeal to and, in fact, try and hire some of the best known legal thinkers on citizenship from the period, trying to amass evidence and opinions that support their position. And abolitionists are important allies in this struggle. I write about a man named William Bates, who in the 1830s will publish a treatise called The Rights of Colored Men. And Yates will spend many, many pages and years of his life pulling together these arguments, publishing them in treatise form, and circulating them so that they can be used in those many individual instances, but also so that they can inform all sorts of deliberative bodies like courts and legislatures and constitutional conventions. So this is not a period during which we have yet the emergence of the kind of sustained and corporatized civil rights apparatus that we associate with the early 20th century. But I think, or I hope you can hear in what I'm describing, the beginnings of that, really modeled in a way that suits the 19th century, but will take a different sort of form in the 20th century.
And we should say it was not, people shouldn't take for granted that abolitionists would follow that, would be looking to strategize on how blacks could become citizens. There was a, you know, I don't know, you would have a better sense than I, but a significant portion of abolitionists whose resolution was more like, yeah, no, not citizenship, just you go somewhere else. Or
Well, yes. So those folks we call colonizationists.
Right.
And they organize, or I should say, they anticipate the end of slavery. Colonizationists do, but they also look forward, if you will, to maintaining the United States as a white man's country. And so colonization has raised funds and organized, outfit ships, established the colony of Liberia in West Africa, to fulfill a vision in which once slavery ends, former slaves will be removed from the United States and relocated to West Africa. So that is a brand of anti-slavery thought. There are other anti-slavery thinkers like the radical William Lloyd Garrison who reject the Constitution, interpret the Constitution to be a compact with slaveholders and would not look to this language that black activists are looking to as a way to resolve the question of African-American rights. Garrison rejects the Constitution, but many black activists do and increasingly will, including figures like Frederick Douglass, increasingly will, as we move into the 1840s and 1850s, look directly to the Constitution for solutions to the problems of slavery and the aspirations to citizenship.
I want to swing back around to Reconstruction and sort of maybe on some level Garrison's perspective was in, at least in some ways acquiesced to insofar as that there was a need to have an explicit amendment. But before we get there, I'm just super curious about this part about it. There was a Supreme Court case about the Second Amendment talking about whether in the rights to interstate travel and whatnot, and that there was a ruling that free black people, unlike white people, would have to apply for documents, both I think in the context of the Second Amendment, and I think maybe also for interstate travel. But I'm most interested in the Second Amendment because I wonder if there is like some fodder there for people today who are looking for some argument about requirements regarding, gun ownership, if they couldn't look to that. I mean, obviously we wouldn't want to base it on the fact that some people were black and some people were white, but if the idea that this right could be abridged in some fashion, it would be interesting. Am I barking up a wrong tree? And if so, we can go and move to the other tree.
Here's what I would say, because I think you're raising something very important. It really isn't until the 20th century that the Bill of Rights, as we know it today, comes to be understood as protecting a panoply of individual interests. So while there is a Second Amendment in the Constitution before the Civil War, it doesn't have a jurisprudence that's developed around it. And so people aren't reaching for the Second Amendment when they are looking to keep firearms or be licensed to have firearms. But state governments and localities are indeed regulating the ownership and the use of firearms before the Civil War. And Maryland is typical in that in regulating firearms, the state draws a clear line between the rights it extends to white citizens and the rights it extends to black citizens at the same time. So African Americans in a state like Maryland can possess and own firearms, but in order to do so, they have to, surmount an additional hurdle. And that hurdle is they must come into a local courthouse, establish their character to the satisfaction of the court, reveal the purpose for their interest, both in owning a gun and in travel, which you also mentioned. And then they receive, if the court approves, a license or a permit to do so. But even absent the Second Amendment, before the Civil War, there's a question that the possession of a firearm in a city like Baltimore, the capacity to carry a firearm openly in a city like Baltimore, is one sign of one's political standing in the community. And African-American men, yes, they look to possess guns for their own safety and security. They look to have guns in order to hunt and to sustain their families and their communities. And at the same time, we know that this capacity to carry a gun in the 1850s has a symbolic value. It is a sign that one is a full or a fuller member of a body politic in a city like Baltimore before the Civil War, where guns are instruments of political culture and literal weapons of either getting out the vote or suppressing the vote in a decade like the 1850s. And so there's deep meaning associated with guns, even if they don't yet rise to the level of a constitutional right in this period. That will really be a question for the 20th century.
So so ultimately, when we look at the 15th Amendment the 14th Amendment.
Yes.
We're just looking at a culmination of work that happened prior to the war in many respects, right? I mean, this is not like a mm-hmm. new idea that we need to develop at this point. When we look, you know, and the idea of birthright citizenship has obviously come up more recently. Give me your sense of like what was there alternate versions, I guess, of like the 14th or the 13th Amendment that could have been drawn up that would, I don't know, make it more, I mean, less susceptible, and maybe it's not really susceptible to attacks, but we're seeing them attack the idea of it. Was there an alternate version?
That's a great question. I think where we are now, and I certainly am not an insider at the White House to be certain what the thinking is there. But if I'm correct, what's going on right now is that there is a push to rethink the somewhat cryptic language in the 14th Amendment that, while generally, persons born in the United States are citizens of the United States, the amendment makes an exception for persons not subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. And even when I say those words, you understand, right, how murky a question right. that might be. Now, we know what Congress intended, but we also know today, there are figures in Washington who would like to revisit that clause and to use it to say that the children of undocumented immigrants are not subject to the jurisdiction of the United States and hence are not entitled to claim birthright citizenship. And so were we to turn back the hands of time, we might have asked Congress to be more explicit about who it was referring to and what it was referring to when it inserted this cryptic clause, such that it would not be subject to reinterpretation and, in my view, misinterpretation in the 21st century.
It's almost like 100. It's almost 180 degrees. Misinterpreted. Like, I mean, it seems to me that the actual reading
is
of subject to the jurisdiction thereof of the United States is expands on the notion of people who are born in the United States. So in other words, if the United States controls some territory that is not officially the United States, that you are actually eligible for birthright citizenship because
it turns out you're not. It turns out you're not. And that's important to say, that people who are born in United States territories are citizens subject to the terms of Congress, not the terms of the 14th Amendment. And so some people are birthright citizens by virtue of an act of Congress, right? It's a legal fiction, even if they are born outside of the United States. But people who live, for example, today are born in American Samoa are not birthright citizens. They are U.S. nationals, and they have rights that flow from that status, but they are not, they are deemed by Congress to be not born in the United States. And that's where things are turning with respect to this clause in the 14th Amendment. The sub-question is who has the right or the power or the authority to interpret that cryptic clause? The president has told us of late that he thinks he does, and he's going to do that by way of an executive order. Others make the argument that it is Congress that has the right to interpret that provision in the 14th Amendment. And still others argue that only the federal courts, ultimately right. The U.S. Supreme Court, has the authority. And we have not tested that question directly in our history. And that is where I think we are. It is a moment of profound uncertainty for people whose citizenship is being drawn into question because this question, I think, ultimately will be in the hands of the U.S. Supreme Court should it be formally posed. And I don't think we know what this U.S. Supreme Court would decide. You are correct. It would be a profound and radical departure from everything we've ever known or believed or practiced when it comes to birthright. If one is born in California, one is a citizen of the United States, for example. That is the example of Kamala Harris. But I think we don't know yet what this U.S. Supreme Court might do with this question. And for me, then, that requires us to exercise just a bit of caution when drawing conclusions, because as we know, there are people, our families, our friends, our neighbors, our coworkers, lives are on the front line, right. And we don't think can offer an ironclad assurance that we know how the Supreme Court will interpret that clause in the 14th Amendment.
Well, it's a fascinating...
Even as we think we know how they should.
Right. It's a fascinating question. I mean, you know, if they want to open up that door, one wonders what's the limiting principle, right? Like, I mean, because if your own birth does not guarantee you citizenship in the United States, well then why should your parents' birth in the United States guarantee you citizenship? And so on and so on. I mean, if theoretically, you know, there's nothing in there to indicate. If you determine that your birth is not a function of your citizenship, well, you know, at one point we all came over here with the parents of immigrants, and why should what's the limiting principle? But I guess we'll find.
You're right. I mean, which is to say, we live in a time where, the box, the rules, right, our norms about citizenship are being scrutinized and questioned very deliberately. And I would say we are already there, that you don't need to dig deep into the news coverage of the day in order to discover that a U.S. citizen, a birthright citizen, has been detained somewhere in the United States. That person's documents have been drawn into question. That person has been held against their will and against their rights until days pass, weeks pass, and their citizenship status is affirmed. That is already happening here in 2019. And my sense is that we are in an era in which the vulnerable, the exceptional folks who are whose citizenship has always been fragile because of racism are on the front lines of this. And I think you're not wrong to suggest that you don't know where it ends, because to undo birthright is to open the door to a political and legal regime in which perhaps anyone who is a member of a despised community, and I use that term qualifiedly, right, but you take my point, anybody, be you the child of a Communist Party member or a Muslim immigrant or a Mexican immigrant, there are many, many communities of unpopular people in this country and despised communities in any given political moment. And I think we are already in an era when that kind of thinking is distorting, yep, and remaking the principle of birthright. And it won't come immediately, right? The reckoning won't come immediately for middle-class white Americans born in the United States. That's not likely, but I think we're all on notice that this political era, this administration is committed to challenging our fundamental values when it comes to citizenship, including the principle of birthright. And where that ends, I don't think, in fact, we know.
The book is Birthright Citizens, A History of Race and Rights in Antebellum America. Professor Martha S. Jones, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. We're going to put a link to your book at majorityreportradio.com, and we will put it in the podcast and YouTube descriptions. Thanks again.
Thanks so much.